Today's Teisho will be on Case 31 in the Gate of No Barrier, the Mumonkan, the U Men Kwan. Joshu investigates an old woman. A monk asked an old woman, "What is the way to Taisan?" The old woman said, "Go straight on." When the monk had proceeded a few steps, she said, "A good, respectable monk, but he too goes that way." Afterwards, someone told Joshu about this. Joshu said, "Wait a bit. I will go and investigate the old woman for you." The next day, he went and asked the same question, and the old woman gave the same answer. On returning, Joshu said to his disciples, "I have investigated the old woman of Taisan for you." Mumon's comment: the old woman only knew how to sit still in her tent and plan her campaign. She did not know when she was shadowed by a spy. Though old Joshu showed himself clever enough to take a camp and overwhelm a fortress, he displayed no trace of being a great general. If we look at them, they both have their faults. But tell me, what did Joshu see in the old woman? Mumon's verse: the question was like the others, the answer was the same. Sand in the rice, thorns in the mud. This story might not make too much sense initially, so let me offer a little background to flesh it out a little bit. A monk asked an old woman, "What is the way to Taisan?" In other words, when I imagine this story, I imagine that there's a monk who's supposed to be going to Taisan, and he stops to ask an old woman for directions. And she says, "Go straight ahead." When the monk had proceeded a few steps, however, she said, "Ah, good, respectable monk, but he too goes that way." Now, my understanding of this is that this monk is traveling, and he's looking for a place called Taisan, and he's lost, and he asks an old woman how to get to Taisan. And she says, "Go straight ahead." And then he starts walking straight ahead, and she says, "Oh, so you're a monk, you're supposed to know something, but you know, you're going in the wrong direction too, or are you?" So it's a kind of a challenge to the monk. It's kind of a challenge to his self-confidence. Now, I don't think that this old woman is being mean at all, or belittling this monk. You know, the history of Zen is filled with enlightened women as well as enlightened men. Unfortunately, the koan collections, which were compiled by men, tend to leave out some of the great women teachers of Zen tradition. And there are a number of historians inside and outside of the Zen world who are trying to repair this situation by doing work on some of these great women masters. Some of them may be lost to history, but there may indeed be records of them. There may be recordings of their koans, for example, and their teachings. Unfortunately, many of the monks in the world of Zen felt threatened by women practitioners. This is a human situation. And unfortunately, women didn't get their rightful attention in these koan collections and in the history of Zen in particular. But this can change at any time, starting right now. It may be already, there was a bit of a change when this koan was written down, and a number of other koans also, because once in a while in the Mumonkan, we encounter these old women who are deeply enlightened. It's kind of interesting. There's a number of these old women who are in the Mumonkan and in Zen tradition, who challenge monks or masters and demonstrate extraordinary insight. Some of you may know about the story of Diamond Shu, who was a great master in Tang Dynasty China, whose specialty was the Diamond Sutra. And he had heard about the Zen sect in China. He was someone who studied the Diamond Sutra, but he wasn't a Zen monk. He was a Buddhist monk from another sect. And his sect put great emphasis on the study of the sutras. And when he heard about this this group of people called the Zen monks and nuns who didn't believe it was important to study the sutras, he thought this was blasphemy, and he set out to challenge them. And he packed up his backpack with all his sutras and went up into the area where Zen was flourishing. And he stopped off at an inn and asked an old woman for directions. And she asked him some questions that exposed his fundamental ignorance. So we have another case like this here of an old woman, mysterious old woman, living alone, practicing the way and cultivating deep awareness, and doing this outside the structure of male-dominated religious practice. And so there's an element of this in the koan. You have a monk who's supposed to know something, and you have an old woman who's not supposed to know very much about enlightenment. And they encounter each other here, but the tables are turned. Because it's the monk who doesn't know very much about enlightenment, and it's the old woman who is perhaps deeply awake. So a monk is trying to go on a journey to a place called Taisan. Gets lost and asks a mysterious old woman, "How do I get there? How do I get there?" And she says, "Go straight on, go straight on." But when the monk had proceeded a few steps, she sort of undermines him or tests his confidence. She says, "Are you sure that's straight on? Are you sure you're going in the right direction?" And it completely undermines his confidence. Afterward, he tells his Dharma brothers at the temple about this. He says, "You know, I went out to find Taisan, and I ran into this old woman, and she made a fool out of me." I almost imagine him going back sort of crying to Joshu and saying, "That old woman made a fool out of me." And Joshu said, "Wait a bit, I will go and investigate the old woman for you." The next day he went and asked the same question, and the old woman gave the same answer. On returning, Joshu said to his disciples, "I have investigated the old woman of Taisan for you." So this is the story. I really love this story. It's partly about women and men in the Tang Dynasty and the way women were not necessarily offered the same opportunities to cultivate enlightened mind as men. And this is just a fact. And yet, there were women who, in spite of these, in spite of being excluded and not adequately supported, were able to achieve the highest levels of awakening. So that's part of this koan, and an important part. But on another level, this koan is not just about the the way women have been treated or represented or misunderstood. It's about how we encounter the world, how we understand anything, and how it's possible to get beyond our assumptions and prejudices. And this is not just an ethical issue or a political problem. It has to do with the perception itself and the cultivation of awakened mind. On some level, politics, culture, all of these things come back to the cushion, I think. You know, this is a koan about a monk encountering a woman and not being able to see her for what she really is, deeply awake. You know, you have to ask yourself, you know, in the fall, the Dalai Lama is going to come here, and he's going to give a speech at the stadium, and, you know, 80,000 people are going to show up and listen to the Dalai Lama. And many of these people have never read anything by the Dalai Lama, but it's the Dalai Lama, you know. And they're all going to go, and they're going to hear the Dalai Lama speak, and he's going to come out in his robes, and he's going to have his entourage. He's actually a very humble person, but you have to ask yourself, you know, if he didn't have his robes, and you ran into him on the bus, you know, on your way over here to Livingston campus, there's a strange old man sitting on the bus, wearing a checkered shirt and blue jeans, you know, let's say. Would you recognize that he was deeply awake? That's sort of a dimension of this koan. In this case, there's the gender issue also. You know, this monk assumes this is just an old woman. What could she possibly know, except maybe the way to get to Taisan? But she knows so much more than that. Well, why can't he see it? And so this is really about, not just about the way men don't see women, don't value women, but how we don't see many things, why we don't see many things. How is it possible for us to really encounter the world as it actually is and push aside or sweep aside all of these veils of ignorance, fear, hearsay, enculturation that stand between us and the way things actually are. How is that possible? That's what this koan is really all about. So it's quite an important koan. We have all of these veils. You know, people who come to sit at the beginning classes on Monday and Friday night have heard a little something about meditation. I don't know what exactly they've heard. But, you know, one of the first things I try to get them to do is to think about meditation as an attempt to come into contact with the real world. You know, many people become interested in Eastern religion, so to speak, or meditation practice, or mysticism, so to speak, because they feel that they understand the real world, and it's an interesting place, and not much is available there. So sometimes I think the motivation is to get involved in something like Zen because you're trying to find an extraordinary realm, transcendent reality, and so on and so on. This is very common. The real world is not interesting. I've been there for X number of years, and I can tell you it's boring and empty. This is very common, I think, way of thinking about life. So when people come into the Zendo, you know, I try to address that head on in a kind of gentle way. I try to say, you know, often we are in a kind of dream state in our daily lives, and that Zen is about getting out of the dream and into the real. And I don't know if that registers, but sooner or later it's going to register with anybody who practices Zen. Because even if we start sitting in the belief that the reality is right here, and it's obvious. If you practice long enough, you begin to realize how many veils, how many layers stand between us and the real world, and how difficult it is to really come into contact with reality. And that the truth is, you know, humans spend very little time in contact with the real world, and it's actually a great pity. This old woman would really be someone important to know, really be someone from whom one could learn a lot, really be someone with whom you could have marvelous experiences. But if we're not prepared for that, you know, nothing's going to happen. You know, so often in life we're just not prepared for this amazing world that's right in front of us. So this koan is sort of getting at this issue. You know, how can we encounter the old woman for what she really is? The old woman, you could say, is life itself. Right? Is life itself. How can we encounter life itself for what it really is? And this is difficult. If you do Zen, you know this. You know, people come in and I say, well, just watch your breath. Let's just watch the breath. And, you know, typically people begin by thinking, what could be simpler? I'm going to sit on the cushion, I'm going to straighten my back, and I'm going to watch the breath. And it is so difficult to do, as you may remember. You know, you sit on the cushion, you're trying to focus on your breath, and this whole screen of thoughts, associations, fears, and anxieties just draws itself over your awareness, and you're unable even to see the breath for long stretches of time. And you get swept into the stream of consciousness that carries you far from your breath. You pull the mind back to the breath, back to the breath. And of course, all the time that you're struggling to encounter the breath, you have all these assumptions about what Zen practice should be and what transcendent experience might be. Perhaps you think this is a waste of your time. You know, I've actually had people who have come into Dokusan and said, I wish you would take me off the breath koan. And I might say, well, you know, why? They say, well, I'm breathing. I think. And I myself was like that. You know, I thought that my teacher was going to take me into the Dokusan room at some point and reveal the secret techniques to me. And I know you think I'm kidding, or you might think I'm kidding, but I assure you I'm not. I really thought that, you know, I had read somewhere that in Buddhism there are the exoteric tradition and the esoteric. In other words, the public tradition and the secret tradition. You know, esoteric and exoteric. I love those words. So I was waiting for Genki to show me the esoteric tradition, right? We bow, we recite the sutras, etc. But I thought one day I'm going to go in there and he's going to say, okay, here it is. Right? Say, you know, do this, clap your hands, spin around, and, you know, the doors will open. And I kept sitting on the cushion trying to focus on my breath, thinking, what's with the breath? And this is so common. You know, I had spent years, literally years, reading philosophy, and I had read a lot about mysticism. I'd read about Christian mysticism, Jewish mysticism, Sufi mysticism. I had read a wonderful book by Alexandra David Neal. You may have heard of her, but it's called something like Magic and Mystery in Tibet. This was one of my... You know, she talks about people who enter trances and do fast walking across Tibet. And they're in the most amazing state of, like, trance walking. And she says they move almost as fast as a horse. She said she once saw a monk coming over the horizon, and it was just like a choo-choo train, you know. They were just like, just breath, 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 you know. His eyes were glazed, and she said, he didn't see me. And then he moved off into the distance. It was like, ah. And I thought, that's it. You know, I want to be that monk, you know. I was stuck with the breath, you know, this is not. I think that practice is called Lung Gong Pa, or something like that, Lung Gong Pa. I wanted Lung Gong Pa, not breath perception meditation. And so I had all of this stuff to overcome. I couldn't be with the moment, couldn't be with the breath. And I've talked about the fact before that I tried to be ingenious, I tried to be creative, I wrote poems, I brought things into the Dokusan room like flowers and odd-shaped rocks, you know, and couldn't be with the breath because I had all of these assumptions and also personal fears, right? I was so afraid that I wasn't going to be special. I wasn't going to be awake. And I thought if I can just go in there and say something extraordinary to the Roshi, he will see that I'm a unique and special person. Unfortunately, I couldn't find anything to say that would convince him of that. So I just kept going in and not dealing with the breath. This is like a fundamental problem of Zen practice. We have all kinds of assumptions, beliefs, values that get in the way and screen our experience of reality. But this is, actually a serious human problem beyond Zen practice. You know, how do we encounter anything that's unfamiliar, anything that that doesn't fit our preconceptions? How is it ever possible for us to get beyond our preconceptions? Because this is really a crucial issue. You know, when people from Europe came to the United States, came to this continent for the first time, they had never encountered what you could call primal nature, you know, primal forests. Maybe they had encountered it 1,000 years before, but forgotten all about it. And in the United States, at the time that Europeans first arrived here, they were like a pristine forests. Supposedly, the wildlife was so great that flocks of birds would fly over, obscuring the sun. This is probably not an exaggeration. Rivers were filled with fish, and you know, this is apparently accurate. You know about the buffalo, that herds of buffalo were so great that it would take days for a single herd to pass a particular location. So this miraculous continent teeming with natural life. And when the first Europeans arrived here, they were terrified of the forest, and they thought it was like the devil's lair. And people associated the forest with evil and danger. And so clearing the forest was like doing war with evil or doing war with the devil. This is actually true. Later in American culture, after maybe a century and a half, we began to have people who saw nature a different way. We began to produce people who like Thoreau, or later on, John Muir. These were people who began to see nature as like a sacred text. You know, John Muir used to go off into the wilderness, and he's responsible, for example, for saving Yellowstone Park. He used to go off in the wilderness with his gun, his little bit of flour, a blanket, and that's it. And he would go off and take care of himself for months. And when he was out in the wilderness, he actually thought of it as, he used to call it like the second Bible. Like the wilderness was the second book of the second divine book. It took about 150 years though, maybe a little more than that, for people to get from looking at the natural world as evil and dangerous to seeing it as holy and wonderful. So it wasn't easy to do. It wasn't easy to do. And it took a lot of destruction, lot of confusion before people could change their way of thinking. This is also happening right now in the world with the different cultures encountering each other. When I was growing up, it was still the case where I was growing up. At one time I lived in Southern Virginia. My father was stationed on a military base there. And in the late 60s, when I was a little kid and I was growing up on the base there in Southern Virginia, white people and black people absolutely never intermingled. And there was a black grocery store and a white grocery store. And I went to a school that was entirely white. And throughout the day, I had no contacts with people of color. And this was the way it was. It seemed natural, and so it's taken our culture really more than almost 200 years to begin to see people of color for what they really are. So we have, we have personal reasons for not dealing with reality. We have our fantasies and our dreams of Tibet or whatever. We have cultural reasons for not dealing with reality. And we probably have, neurological reasons for not dealing with reality. I was, after the Thursday night sit, about a week ago, I came home, and my wife Barbara had just gotten home too. We both get home at about the same time, around 9:30 in the evening. And she had had a really rough day, so she was sitting watching the tube. And she had on TV, there was something very interesting for a change. And it was it wasn't that interesting, I guess. But, it was somewhat interesting, which what I thought of as a change. It was about how people who put together movies have to have a person who is in charge of continuity. Because they don't film movies continuously, right? So they'll do a scene, and they'll film a scene, and then they'll film some other scenes, and then later they'll return to the events in the first scene. So Brad Pitt may be waiting for the leading lady of the movie to come down the escalator. So they'll film Brad Pitt waiting at the bottom of the escalator. And then a week later, he'll be back at the escalator and they're filming him again. And this is how they make movies. They don't film the first scene first, the second scene second, the third scene third. That's not how they do it. They do the fifth scene first and the tenth scene next and the third scene. And somebody is in charge of making sure that when Brad Pitt is wearing a suit at the foot of the escalator the first time, he's wearing the same suit the next time. It's tremendously confusing. And of course, they screw up all the time, and we don't notice it, which is interesting to me. And it showed the original clip of, he was waiting for this woman to come down the escalator. She came down and they did something, walked away or something like that. And then they showed the error. And it's fascinating because he's waiting for this woman to come down the escalator and he's holding a bowl of shrimp and eating the shrimp. In the next scene, he's holding a plate of shrimp and eating the shrimp. In the next scene, he's holding a bowl of shrimp and eating the shrimp. In the next scene, it's the plate again, right? So it's obvious. I could tell you about others. I could go on and on. I thought it was fascinating. But the most fascinating thing about it was that the mind obviously doesn't focus on the inconsistencies, right? It sort of says, it sort of prefers continuity. Right? So the mind prefers not to notice the inconsistencies. So this is really, all of these things are part of the reason it's so difficult to achieve an experience of the real, that we have to work so hard for it. It's culture, personal psychology. You know, we have investments in what we've always believed. Some people right now, in my opinion, evolution is real. I think it's absolutely incontrovertibly real. We have cultural and personal reasons for fearing the teaching of evolution. And so it's going to be a real struggle, I think, to come to terms with what is, I think, a fact of nature, of reality. So, very difficult for humans to encounter the real. And this is partly why Zen practice is such a challenge, that what we're trying to do on the cushion, breath by breath, is peel away these layers of culture, these layers of personal fear and attachment, and perhaps we're trying to correct a kind of cognitive or neurological prejudice in favor of consistency. But you know, it can be done. But it doesn't get done the way people think. You know, and I think that's what makes this koan so important. You know, it doesn't get done the way people think. We imagine enlightenment or awakening as something like this. You know, you're sitting on the cushion, you're sitting, watching the breath, and then all of a sudden, boom, right? There's this flash of insight, you know, and, you know, everything becomes luminous, and, you know, you feel transformed, or you feel like you're floating, you know, and you might cry, you might laugh, you know, and then you go in and see the teacher, and the teacher says, yes, that's it, you've done it. You know. Now, those experiences actually do sometimes happen. They really do, especially with Dai Kensho. But, you know, the truth is, in Zen, it usually doesn't happen that way. What usually happens is that you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching the breath or you're working with your koan and you notice something different, but you pass it by, right? You notice maybe something just for a second and then you walk by it and you go on looking for what you think is really the thing you should be looking for. See, so your koan is saying, go find something, but we're not telling you what it is, right? And you're supposed to use your dharma eye, enter into deep samadhi, deep mushin, enter that blankness, and then look with your dharma eye, right? So the koans, we're giving you some hints, but not telling you what exactly you should be looking for. And you're looking, watching the breath. And then you might notice something like, something odd happens to you while you're watching the breath. It has nothing to do with the breath. Like maybe you suddenly notice that it feels like your hands and your face have disappeared. And you might think, oh, that's odd. But now back to the breath. And so you might go into the teacher and say, I'm afraid I didn't experience anything today on the cushion. Nothing. And the teacher says, nothing? No, I just watched the breath. Next day, sorry. I just watch the breath. You know, sometimes we walk by what we really should be noticing because we're not quite prepared for it yet. This is so important. You know, when I do Dokusan, when people come in to see me in Dokusan, often they're walking right by the answer to their koan. They're noticing something, but they don't see its importance. Or sometimes people will notice something and then 3 days later they'll tell me about it, you know, and they'll say, well, you know, actually the other day this happened to me. Oh, really? Well, that was the answer to your koan, you know, this actually happened. So people miss the real because they're not looking for it. They think they're looking for something else. I hope this is making sense. But, you know, when you're dealing with the koan, you have a kind of presupposition or assumption about what should happen. And when it doesn't happen, you walk right by it, see? Over and over again, finally, you know, you might notice, could it be this? Could this be the answer? Or the teacher might just say, well, by the way, that was the answer to your koan. And at the end, you might feel disappointed, like, that's the answer? That's nothing. But don't necessarily trust that response. That's nothing. Zen practice is a little bit like entering a cave after being out in the sun. You know, you're out in the sun, you go into this cave, and you can't see anything. But little by little, you begin to notice things in the cave. It's like your eyes are adjusting, and you begin to see. Maybe you begin to hear. Maybe your senses are transformed. But while you're groping around in the cave, sometimes you may miss very important insights because you're just not prepared to see them yet. This is the essence of Zen practice. Another element of Zen practice that's very important to talk about is that it's not always the case, even after you've encountered reality, that you're fully able to deal with it. So, a lot of Zen practice is staying with the real, staying with the world, long enough to begin to have it seep into your heart, body, and mind. Maybe that doesn't make any sense, but even after Daikensho, people don't know what happened to them. Sometimes people answer the Mu Koan. They don't know why I accepted the answer, and they know they felt weird, but they don't know what happened to them. They don't consciously know. And they may not really understand on a deeper level what happened to them. Once you are deeply in Mu Xin, once you have deeply entered that consciousness we call Mu Xin, it takes a long time before you can be fully awake to Mu Xin. You have to live with Mu Xin a long time and let it soak into your body, heart, and mind. This is very important. Even after Daikensho, people don't... It's not the case that people have Daikensho and then everything is revealed to them. That's not true. What happens is you have Daikensho and it's this amazing experience, and then you go home and you start sitting again and you notice things are a little different. And as you go on, you notice they're very different. And as you go on, they're very, very different. And then very, very, very different. So it's like that. See, it's not like all at once the scales fall from your eyes and everything is revealed. We're not ready for that. Right? What it is we have this, we crash into reality and we open our eyes and see it. And then sometimes we just close our eyes again. But little by little, we keep crashing into reality. It begins to change us, but it takes a while. It has to seep into our bones, seep in. This is sort of like, there's this myth in Zen practice, the myth of Kensho, right? And it's this idea that we're going to have this experience and that everything will be revealed. And I've tried to explain that it's not like that. In Zen practice, you start with the breath koan. And one day you're sitting on the cushion and you feel like your body is disappearing, or you feel like you're turning around on the cushion, although you're not. Or you feel like you're floating, or you feel like you're expanding, and believe it or not, that's Kensho. That's your first encounter with the real. See, you're not actually floating off the cushion. What has happened to you is that your mind has entered non-dualistic awareness. Your attention is now not divided or screened off by thought. Your attention is fused with the moment. And in that state, ordinary body sensations feel really weird and strange. Right? You feel like your face has disappeared, or you feel like energy is coming out the top of your head, or like electricity is flowing down your arms. See, these are actually normal body sensations experienced with a purified awareness. But then, you know, we come away, usually these kinds of experiences take place at Sesshin. Sesshin is over, we come home, we're back at school, we're back in our job, we're watching television, you know, whatever, you know. Little by little, the door that opens sort of closes up. Not permanently, so, you know, don't get discouraged, but it closes up a little bit. So then we do some more practice, we have another Sesshin, door opens, closes up a little bit. Little by little, the door stops closing. You know, and the Daikensho door really stays open. But it takes a while for our eyes to adjust to the darkness. So with our practice, you know, with our koan practice, we have to spend a lot of time just bumping into what we're looking for, but not recognizing what it really is. This is, and it's right there. You know, after people have Daikensho, one of the things they always talk about is, my God, it was right there all along. They mean literally, it was right at the edge of my awareness from moment to moment. I just didn't look over there and see it. So a lot of Zen practice is bumping into what we're looking for and not being able to deal with it yet. This is true with the Mu Koan. If you're working on the Mu Koan, you're calling Mu, Mu. Eventually you notice, or I'll just tell you. You know, at some point I might just say, look, when you breathe out and you call Mu, look at your mind. What's happening in your mind? You'll say, nothing, it's blank. It's like, ah, congratulations, that is Mu Xin. Now, you know, if you're not prepared properly, you just think, well, big deal. You know, if that's what Zen is about, you know, I'm out of here. Not prepared to appreciate what is actually in front of you, bumping into reality, but not prepared to appreciate it. And this is quite commonplace, you know. So, you know, people sit there and they look at that blankness and look at that blankness and think, well, what is this all about? You know, this is pointless. You know, I wanted the secret initiation. I wanted the Lung Gong Pa. But this is much more wonderful than Lung Gong Pa. If you keep looking at that blank wall of Mu Xin, you know, it's so transformative. You know, that is the face of God. That is the door into big mind. Literally, the door into big mind. So, hard to maybe believe at certain points in your practice, but I swear to you, if you keep going, you won't be disappointed, and what I'm telling you is the truth. Seems so trivial, right? You watch the breath, you look at your mind, nothing. What could be less interesting than nothing? But if you keep practicing, something amazing begins to happen, because that's your whole perceptual apparatus is changed by dwelling in that blankness. The way you think will be changed by dwelling in that blankness. The way your brain works will be changed by dwelling in that blankness. And the way your body works will be changed by dwelling in that blankness. You know, now sometimes we don't really want to be changed, and that's a problem too, right? You know, we begin to encounter the real, and it may not be what we want, and we may not necessarily want to embrace it. And that's a one of the reasons we don't always answer our koans also. But we may bump into this blankness many times before we begin to notice that we feel a certain energy, a certain endless life energy flowing out of that blankness, right? And it builds and it builds and it builds for reasons we don't understand because not prepared to understand, but one day it's overwhelming. It's like this energy possesses us. And it's an amazing experience then. It's something you can probably recognize as amazing. But, you know, I worked on the breath koan for 5 years, and I worked on the Mu koan for about 4 years. And I just couldn't, I kept bumping into it and saying, this is pointless, this is unimportant, this is not what I'm looking for. Where are the mystical experiences? So I had to bump into it for a long time. But, you know, even after I had a deep encounter with the Mu Koan, it took a long time for that experience to soak into my body, mind, and heart and really transform me. This is really very important to understand. If you're waiting for epiphanies, in English we have this word epiphany, it's like a divine revelation, boom. If you're waiting for epiphanies, it's not going to happen that way. A person called me on the phone the other day. This was like a telephone dokusan, which is okay. You can email me, you can call me whenever you like. And this person said, you know, I just don't think I'm in samadhi. I just don't think I'm in samadhi. And I said, well, tell me about what's happening to you. And the person described all these things, and I said, yes, you're in samadhi. And the person just couldn't believe it. All right, if you say so. It was funny, you know. All right, if you say so. I don't know what they were looking for, right? You know, but that's another element. There's another element of this too, you know. You're changed by Zen practice very profoundly. I just sent Pradeep and Sahana an article that about they've been doing new brain research on people who do meditation. And people who do a lot of Zen meditation have, I think it was called something like gamma synchrony. But the brain waves begin to perform in very different ways. And brain functions, multiple brain functions, are all harmonized by Zen practice in ways that impress these researchers very profoundly. So it really changes the way your mind works. But you know, you're not going to notice it. Boom, there's a change. You come in to sit, and you have a good sit. You come in to sit, not so hot. You come in to sit, it was okay. You come in to sit, you know, you're not going to notice all of a sudden that your whole world has been transformed. That's not how it's going to be. You're going to bump into it and miss it, and bump into it and miss it. And then you're going to see it, but you still won't fully appreciate what's happened to you, you know, for a long time. But little by little, this transformation occurs. You know, one day you're going to just get up and be very happy and very alive. Somebody came to, I was talking to somebody the other day, and this person was talking about how much she looked forward to practicing Zen every day. And if you ask this person, well, why, I doubt they could give you a reason. But little by little, sit by sit, really transform. This person said, you know, I just, in my mind, this phrase keeps coming up, the song of Zen. This is like Hakuin Zenji's song of Zen. You know, it's like life unfolds like this beautiful piece of music, going on and on. Always something new, always something unexpected, always something fresh. This is the way of Zen. But it happens gradually, step by step, step. Sometimes it's true. Boom. There's the boom experience. You say, wow, that was amazing. It's not always the case, not usually the case. We encounter the old woman, see? And we don't know who she is. We don't appreciate who she really is. And we walk by and we walk by and we just don't get it. Joshu says, a monk asked an old woman, what is the way to Taisan? The old woman said, just keep going. See, that's the best advice in Zen, right? Just keep going. Good sit, bad sit, just keep going. Just keep sitting. That's perfect. She's deeply awake. How do you encounter the real? How do you encounter the real? Just keep going. Just keep going. when the monk had proceeded a few steps, she said, you're a good monk, but I don't think you really know how to keep going. He has too many self-doubts, right? Too much fear right now. Needs to do more zazen. So he goes back to see Master Joshu, and he says, Master Joshu, this old woman made a fool of me. I'm a monk. She's a nobody. How can this be? I have a PhD in Buddhology, and she's a little nobody. And Joshu knows who she is, probably, or he'll be able to encounter her, or maybe it'll take him a little while. He says, wait a bit. I will go investigate the old woman for you. Next day he went and asked the same question. The woman gave the same answer, go straight ahead. They probably had a wonderful, maybe they did zazen together. See? Oh, I think that's true. When I was the attendant for my teacher, I was like attendant. My job was to, get tea ready and things like that for the teacher. And a visiting Zen master came to our temple. And, I had thought in my naivete that when Zen masters get together, they exchange secret esoteric teachings, right? They talk about past lives, Well, I was a pirate in my past life, Well, I was a general, Genki, I said, well, do you talk about reincarnation? And Genki said, of course we don't. We have a cup of tea together. So this beautiful, the real is so beautiful. The real is so beautiful. The world is so wonderful, just as it is. So maybe Joshu and the old woman had tea and did zazen together. On returning, Joshu said to his disciples, I have investigated the old woman of Taisan for you. He doesn't tell him what he encountered. Mumon's comment. Now remember, when Mumon criticizes somebody, he's paying them a compliment. So Mumon's comment, the old woman only knew how to sit still in her tent and plan the campaign. She did not know when she was shadowed by a spy, though old Joshu showed himself clever enough to take a camp and overwhelm a fortress. He displayed no trace of being a great general. If we look at them, they both have their faults. In other words, both were deeply enlightened. But tell me, what did Joshu see in the old woman? How do you encounter the real? How do you encounter the real? Mumon's verse. The question was like the others. The answer was the same. Sand in the rice, thorns in the mud. Sand in the rice. How do you separate sand and rice? How do you separate thorns and mud? So often, what we're looking for is the sand. What we're looking for are the thorns. So often what we find when we're sitting is what we've been looking for, but it's not necessarily what we started out by wanting. We don't find what we want, we find what's real. It takes a little time to adjust to that. But ultimately, if you follow this practice long enough, you learn to want what is real. Yeah? You learn to want what is real. And then this world, as Joshua once said, then everything becomes your rice. Everything becomes heaven. All you have to do is lean down and eat. It's a beautiful life.